This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. There's a medical mystery in Western Washington and nationwide that we're going to begin with today. An uptick in an illness that paralyzes the limbs of the children who get it. 8 local children have been hospitalized this fall. 1 has died. Seattle Times health reporter Jonelle Alicia is reporting on this. Jonelle, welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
What is happening to these kids?
First of all, we've actually had one additional case reported today, another child, a 9th child, hospitalized at Seattle Children's. And what's been happening with these kids this fall is that they are coming down with sudden limb weakness or paralysis, and some of them have become very ill.
And you write that this illness is known as acute flaccid myelitis. What do we know about it?
That's right. Well, you know, we don't, and the CDC doesn't know an awful lot about it. It's a syndrome that is characterized, as we said, by paralysis or limb weakness, and sometimes brain swelling, and very, very occasionally death. It happens when kids get kind of a common illness, and all of a sudden their families will notice that they have some kind of weakness in a limb.
You said occasional death. I mentioned the loss of one Bellingham boy. How dangerous, how fatal is this disease or this syndrome?
Yeah, there are very, very few deaths associated so far. What the CDC tells us they're concerned about is what appears to be an uptick in the cases this year. They updated their totals and said that through September of this year, there have been 89 confirmed cases of AFM in 33 states. And in 2014, there were 120 cases. So far, only 2 of the cases here in Washington State have been confirmed AFM, and the little boy who died, the Bellingham boy, Daniel Ramirez, was not confirmed to be a case, but the CDC is still investigating.
I understand you spoke with Daniel's family. What did you hear from them?
Yeah. They said that he became ill a couple of weeks ago with high fever and vomiting, and then his parents took him to a hospital in Bellingham, and he was flown to Seattle Children's, and he just got worse and worse and tragically died.
Now, Jonelle, of course, we want to be careful here because it is scary to hear there's a mysterious, possibly fatal disease. And how alarming is AFM compared with other illnesses?
Well, we know that these cases occur only in about 1 of every million people, even with this cluster here and even with the rise in cases that CDC is concerned about. While there is no specific cause, we can't tell parents of a way to specifically prevent it. But the standard ways that we keep our kids healthy by washing hands, staying away from sick people, wiping off surfaces is what health officials are recommending to keep kids from falling ill.
And what about vaccinations? We can't help think about the fact that, as we've learned, there are many people in this area, this state, who don't vaccinate their children. Does that play any role in this?
No, what I'm told by health officials is that there is no evidence with AFM that people who are vaccinated are any more or any less likely to come down with it. So there is really no link between this illness and vaccinations that we know of.
Finally, Jonelle, what can we remember about this? What could a parent do to watch for or protect their kids from, any illness? But let's talk now about AFM.
Right. Well, parents need to take the steps that we mentioned to keep their kids healthy. But, you know, if they see any sign of any weakness in arms or legs or maybe any facial drooping, they should make sure to contact their healthcare providers just as soon as possible.
We've been talking with Seattle Times health reporter Jonelle Alicia, telling us about an uptick in AFM, acute flaccid myelitis, and we'll keep watching. Jonelle, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we, speaking of disease, we'll be talking about personalized medicine coming up this hour. You'll learn about one of Seattle's innovators, a giant of genomics and personalized medicine. That's coming up in about 10 minutes on KUOW's The Record. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. It's 1 week before the national election, and there's been a burst of news about Clinton emails and polls tightening. Let's check in with one election watcher. Dr. Jason Johnson is politics editor at The Root. Good to talk with you again, Dr. Johnson.
Glad to be here. Glad to be here.
What is your take on where the presidential stands 1 week out?
You know, I have to dig back into my mental archives to what I thought was going to happen at the beginning of this year. I think we are looking at a very, very close popular vote and probably a reasonably safe victory by Hillary Clinton in the Electoral College. There are some real questions about whether the polls are tightening and what tightening actually means at a national level. But if you look at most state races, the polls at the state haven't changed that radically in the last month, and that seems to give a slight edge to Hillary Clinton.
Yes. What do you know about polls tightening? That's certainly something we've been hearing over the weekend and today. But you say close popular vote, maybe, but safe Electoral College victory.
Right, right. So, you know, look, we all know, you know, unlike the Seahawks and Cardinals, you can't get a tie in the popular vote, right? Someone's going to win. Someone's going to win. And, you know, and I do think it could be very close. It could be a, you know, 49-7 and a 49-3. But ultimately, when you see polls tightening this late in the race, let's be honest, right? Even if you had the Comey emails, was anyone paying attention to that, which dropped 2 o'clock in the afternoon last Friday? No. You had Halloween. You had baseball. You had people absorbed and interested in other things. No one is changing their mind a week before the election. So what poll tightening really is people who had been claiming they were undecided, because there's really no such thing as undecided voters, are finally deciding to answer polls. And at least throughout history, usually somebody who was noncommittal in answering a poll, when they finally commit, 75% of them tend to break towards the sort of incumbent party. So I think that's why the polls are tightening. Republicans are coming out of the closet saying, yeah, I'm going to hold my nose for Trump, and Democrats are standing firm behind Hillary Clinton.
What is your evidence for your psychologizing about what we really mean when we say we're an undecided voter?
Oh, well, it's even better than psychology. It's my political science degree. I mean, the gist of it is this, and this is something I was, you know, studying as a professor and even in graduate school. So a lot of times when somebody says they're counted as an undecided voter by a poll, what it really is they haven't decided if they're going to vote. Not whether who they're going to vote for. A lot of men and women out there are saying, you know what, I'm registered. I don't know if I feel like getting in line. I don't know if I feel like getting the absentee ballot. But if you push them further and say, hey, look, if somebody asks you right here and right now who would you vote for, most of them are leaning one way or another. So they get counted as undecided voters when they're actually leaning towards one candidate. They just haven't decided if they want to participate in the process.
Okay, so somebody calls them up and they just don't. Why should I commit myself to definitely doing this thing that's off in the future? It doesn't mean that I don't know what I want.
Exactly. It's like buying a car or picking which movie you want to go to. People don't want to give you that answer right now. It's like, hey, you coming to the party Friday? I don't know. Do you like parties? Of course I do. So that's where a lot of this comes from. And those people, again, they're confused for being unsure. And it's perpetuated by, we see it sometimes on the news, we have a group of undecided voters watching the debate. Those people aren't undecided. You can tell by the questions that they ask. But that makes it an interesting horse race narrative. So that's why we hear the story.
So when you hear about the head of the FBI saying mysteriously, once again, looking into some emails related to Hillary Clinton, and we've been hearing about emails all this time, you just discount that as being a big election bombshell?
I think it was grossly unprofessional. And I think it was incredibly inappropriate. And you have people within the administration, you have Loretta Lynch, you have Eric Holder saying, this is not how we do things. You're not supposed to talk about existing investigations. And I'll be honest, to me, what Comey did would be the equivalent of the FBI coming forward and saying, hey, well, we think Barack Obama's name might have come out of the Ashley Madison hack, but we're not really sure. We'll get back to you. I mean, like, you can't throw out that kind of information and not do an investigation. But here's the catch. Is there anyone in America who is actually registered to vote who was going to change their mind? Is there anyone who was voting Hillary Clinton that after this announcement is going to say, well, no, now I think I'm going to vote for Donald Trump? Is there anyone who wasn't already going to vote for Donald Trump, who's going to be any more enthusiastic? No, they already thought Hillary Clinton was supposed to be in jail. So it doesn't make that much of a difference. And what I've seen, and what we've seen in the polling, and some of the people who I've talked to kind of in both campaigns, to be honest with you, is that Democrats, rather than being frustrated or disenchanted by this announcement, they're emboldened. Now they feel that their candidate is under assault. So it seems to have had either a neutral or a positive impact on enthusiasm or support for Clinton, at least internally.
Well, what are we seeing from early voting?
So early voting has been a mixed bag. What you've seen in sort of two key swing states, Cuyahoga County, which is where you've got Cleveland, Ohio, and the sort of the blue part of Ohio, the early turnout in Cuyahoga County is down by about 15% from 2012. That is bad news for Democrats if they actually think they're going to pull off the state of Ohio. Now, those numbers could change. They could improve. You've got Hillary Clinton showing up there later on this week. You've got Jay-Z giving a free concert on Friday. Maybe those numbers will pick up. In Florida, while turnout has increased for Latinos, young people, and single women, African-American early vote turnout in Florida is down by 55% from 2012. So in both of these states, early voting doesn't seem to be working in favor of Democrats, but in North Carolina, Virginia, and other places, it seems to be doing well. So, again, we could have a long night, we could have a short night, and you can't really tell how much early voting is going to matter because, remember, this is the first presidential election in 50 years without the Voting Rights Act. So we have no idea what could actually happen on Election Day.
He's watching. You're watching. He just knows more than you do. That's Dr. Jason Johnson, politics editor at The Root. It's always good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Anytime.
Politics editor, professor at Morgan State University. Seahawks fan as well. Maybe we'll talk Seahawks with them again later this season as we did once before. You're listening to the record on KOW. You know, one group that's turned toward the Democrats in recent years is Asian American voters, including Chinese Americans. And you might expect more of them to vote that way this election, since Donald Trump is so well known for criticizing
China.
One of many, many, many online memes you can find along those lines. But KUOW's Amy Radel reports Trump does have his Chinese American fans.
Given the way Donald Trump talks about China,
China has taken from us so much money, so many jobs.
You might not expect him to be popular there or among Chinese Americans in the U.S. And yet on Friday, an airplane flew over Seattle with the banner Washington Chinese Americans for Trump. John Pomfret is the former Washington Post bureau chief in China. He says there's a lot of pro-Trump talk on Chinese social media platforms.
There's a very active debate within the American Chinese community, as witnessed by that banner on the airplane that just buzzed your office. And also within China on WeChat and then Weibo, these two social media platforms, which are very popular among Chinese.
He says in China, there's a certain nostalgia for what he terms the big political man, a character that Trump inhabits well. And
in China, there's no love lost for Hillary Clinton, partially because in a way, Clinton regained her political mojo in China in 1995. During the International Women's Conference.
That's where Clinton pointedly criticized China's human rights record. She's seen as a hawk on China and an experienced negotiator. Meanwhile, Trump's perceived isolationism would create more room for Chinese leadership to expand.
And so there's kind of this sense, almost this gleeful sense, that the Americans elect this guy, China will really be the beneficiary.
Hao-Yu Wang is a senior majoring in political science at the University of Washington in Seattle. He feels some of that glee.
We don't like Trump as a person, but we like him to, you know, as a tool to kind of bring America down.
Wang says his views aren't necessarily typical of his peers at UW. Many students he knows, both Asian and non-Asian, are supporting Clinton, who Wang sees as tough and experienced. But Wang wants to make his career in China, and he thinks a Trump victory would be good for his home country, which is already on the rise.
We turn the table around. So more and more of us, like international Chinese students, will like to obtain like certain knowledge in the United States and trying to go back and serve our country.
Wang says his support for Trump verges on being sarcastic, but his excitement about what the future holds for him in China is sincere. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
John Pomfret has a new book due out this month on U.S.-Chinese relations, and he's going to be at Seattle's Town Hall on December 2nd talking about that. What is the connection between Donald Trump and the Kremlin? This afternoon, we're going to get into what we know, what is confirmed about any potential Trump-Russian ties. That's coming up on All Things Considered. Also, a lot of American Christians have struggled this year with what faith means when it comes time to make political choices, even whether faith and politics ought to mix. That and more coming up today on KUOW's All Things Considered. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. If I asked you for the Seattle visionaries who have shaped the tech world, I know you could name Bill Gates and Paul Allen, Jeff Bezos. Our next guest says if you don't put Leroy Hood's name in that list, you're missing something. Luke Timmerman has written the new book, Hood, Trailblazer of the Genomics Age. He tells you why Leroy Hood is in the pantheon of Seattle innovators.
Well, Lee Hood really burst onto the scene in the early 90s here in Seattle when he was brought to the University of Washington by none other than Bill Gates with a $12 million gift to establish a new Department of Molecular Biotechnology, they called it at the time. And Hood was well known in biology at that time for leading the team at Caltech that developed the first automated DNA sequencing machine.
Automated DNA sequencing machine. It's a big deal. Why?
That is the tool that made the Human Genome Project possible. Before that came along, people sequenced DNA by hand in the lab. Graduate students would spend their entire career, 4 or 5 years of study, just trying to determine the sequence of one gene that does one thing in the cell, like make insulin, say. And suddenly, you could cast a much wider net. You could determine the entire order of all of those bits of DNA that make us who we are.
Well, that sounds just like the march of technology. Everything gets faster and easier. So why is Leroy Hood so important to that?
Well, he really spearheaded that drive to automate the tools of biology. And with that came the ability to ask bigger, broader questions to gather new kinds of data. So suddenly you could determine the sequence of you or me and see what makes us different. And before, that was just beyond what anybody could even dream of. And now it's routine sort of things that people do in the lab. You can sequence an entire genome in a day.
Doing work like that at greater volume and faster sounds inevitable. So what was so visionary about Leroy Hood when it comes to sequencing our genome?
Well, the funny thing is, biology in those days, in the 70s and 80s, had kind of an anti-technology bias.
Really?
Yeah. It was unlike other fields of science, like chemistry or physics, where it's understood that if you develop some powerful new tool, well, that will open up new frontiers in science. But biology was still kind of stuck in its ways, looking at things through the microscope, and people were afraid that this would be disruptive. And Hood was among this small group of leaders in biology who said, no, we really need to embrace technology and modernize and become much more ambitious in how we do our work.
Is that cautiousness on the part of biology because mixing biology and technology is inherently spooky and weird and dangerous seeming?
Well, that concern has always been there. People have worried about the misuse of genetic data for discriminatory purposes. And Hood is the eternal optimist. So he is pro-technology. And when things have come out at various stages, like when he was coming to the University of Washington, Jurassic Park was the big deal.
Uh-huh.
And that dystopian future of misuse of genetic engineering. And he would always try to engage engage with people and explain in the simplest terms that those sorts of fears were overblown and could be managed with proper oversight. And that's something he continues to deal with today.
Okay, so Leroy Hood was a giant in the early 90s, and then I remember that announcement. Leroy Hood is coming to Seattle. Why did he come here?
Essentially, he wanted to pursue an ambitious new agenda for more tool development, more technology in biology, beyond just the DNA sequencer. And the University of Washington was an ambitious public university that wanted to get into the genomics kind of game and saw him as this world-class biologist who could attract money and other star scientists and really put the university on the map in a big way in this emerging field of science.
It sounded like a pivot point for the University of Washington.
It was. And Bill Gates, at the time, he was in his mid-30s, and he was still very actively engaged in Microsoft and solely focused there. He had never done any sort of philanthropy, and people had been trying to encourage him to support local causes, various causes. And this was the one that captivated his imagination once he personally met Hood, and they hit it off. Here was a character who was blazing a trail in biology, and Gates immediately saw the computational possibilities that eventually you could sort of digitize that genetic data and then let computers do what they do best with it, which is analyze data.
But Gates didn't hire Leroy Hood. Why did he want to put him at great cost at the University of Washington?
Well, Hood was still very much an academic scientist, so pushing the frontiers of knowledge is who he is at the core. Now, Hood also had lots of ideas for how to apply some of those ideas in the business world. Maybe one of these projects that he worked on at some point would spin out into a company, and other people could then run with it and build it and manage it. And that was all part of the package when Hood came to Seattle. People saw him as the sort of guy who could be a spark plug for the biotech industry, which was really just getting started here in Seattle at the time.
Hood only lasted 8 years at University of Washington before forming a company in Seattle. Why did that switch happen?
Well, he left to start his own nonprofit research institute, which then did spin out companies. But that was a long, drawn-out, messy divorce, as I say in the book. And there's a lot of behind-the-scenes administrative battles and bureaucratic turf fights that occurred between he and particularly the dean of the medical school, Paul Ramsey. And Hood had this new vision for what he called systems biology. And this would essentially connect things that occur at the deepest molecular level of the cell all the way up through like whole networks of how genes and cells communicate. It was a very ambitious, kind of unprecedented idea, really, at the time. And it required that he tear down some walls within the academy and build his own fiefdom, I guess you could say. And not everybody at the university wanted to go along with that. Hood found it hard to coexist inside the traditional university structure. And it was painful and at times personal. There was some animosity there. And that sort of story, like people have talked about that or they've rumored about it, but this has never been reported before in such detail as I was able to uncover here with the documentary record.
How has genomics turned out to be life-changing, if it has? What is the most important thing about genomics, those advances?
I'd say right now genomics is in a very exciting time of information gathering. That is, we are learning so much and learning so many things at warp speed, really, about what makes human beings human, what leads us into diseased pathways, all kinds of other plants and other animal species, for that matter, bacteria, how we coexist with bacteria. It's an explosion of knowledge. Now, the Human Genome Project and some of the genomics scientists out there have at times overpromised, that they've sort of implied and even said explicitly that we will get personalized medicine almost right around the corner. And that hasn't happened.
Go take a test, and that test will tell you how you ought to live your life, eat, you know, vitamins, things you ought to worry about, right?
That's right. And we're not there yet. The science is going to take a long, long time to sort through all of those variables that go into making a person healthy or diseased, that delicate dance between genetics and the environment that we live in. So there has been some overpromising. But that shouldn't take away from the genuine excitement, the fact that we can now peer into what used to be a black box. There's never been a better time for biology.
Let's talk about what Leroy Hood has meant to the Seattle area. If he had not come here, what would we be missing?
Oh, that's a great question. Sort of the missing man theory. he really is this force of personality. He's a very charismatic individual. So brilliant, intense, charismatic. He attracts resources and talented young people to come carry out his visions, and serves as a catalyst. He starts things. He started this venture capital-backed incubator in town that's spun out a dozen companies. He's got his institute, which has a couple hundred people working there. He does influential science that other people cite in their peer-reviewed publications. He is a dynamo. And you know, although now he's getting older, he's 78 years old, even then he still has a new startup in town that's raised a good amount of money, Aravail, that's got this idea for scientific wellness. So he's a remarkable individual. He's complicated. He's flawed in some respects. That, I think, comes through in the book as well. My hope is that by telling that story of a character that you can really get interested in. I think almost anybody can get interested in this kind of character. People like to read about people. And
Steve Jobs comes to mind.
Very much so. So if you read the Steve Jobs book, you will not only learn about a fascinating and complicated character, good and bad, but you will also learn a lot about the development of technology over the last 30, 40 years. And a similar concept is at work here. By getting engaged in the story of this complicated individual, you will stay with me, I hope, when we get through some of the more sciencey parts.
That book is called Hood, Trailblazer of the Genomics Age. Luke Timmerman is the author and also founder of the Timmerman Report, which covers the biotech industry. Luke will be at the University Bookstore on November 7th, that's this coming Monday evening. And we're going to be talking medical marijuana later today on KUOW. Oakland, California wants to award new licenses to medical pot dispensaries by giving preference to people with marijuana convictions on their records. The goal is to include more African-American and Latino entrepreneurs, but critics say this plan is rife with problems. You'll hear about it today on KUOW's All Things Considered. Thanks for tuning in to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Well, the wettest October in Seattle history is behind us now. The moldy pumpkin shells are nestling into the compost bin. The World Series is waning, and it's time to celebrate the start of a new and darker month. And here are book watcher Nancy Pearl and KUOW's Marcy Silman with some new pages to turn.
These are thrillers. The author is Becky Masterman. And just like it sounds, and the first of her three books is called Rage Against the Dying. And I really loved, over the course of reading these three books, and the third one is not coming out till next March, but I was fortunate enough to be able to read it. I just loved meeting the main character and getting to know her. Her name is Bridget Quinn, and she's in her late 50s, maybe she turned 60 in one of the books, which you very rarely see in a thriller, right?
Right.
And she has white hair. She very early, so it's, you know, she looks, even with the white hair, younger than she is. She's terrifically fit. She was an FBI agent, recently retired, and her job was really to go undercover with the worst of the worst. So she spent a lot of time tracking serial killers. Not the kind of book I normally like, because I just don't like to spend a lot of time in that world. But these books are so nicely written, and the characters, especially Bridget and her husband, who is a ex-priest, now an ex-philosophy professor at the University of Arizona, are just such interesting people. And it's was fascinating to me the way she, in these three books, the way the cases that she's going to work on, that the book is about, come to her.
I have to ask a question. What is the distinction between a thriller and a mystery?
Well, it used to be that a mystery had a detective. See, it makes much more sense in Britain when it's called crime fiction.
Right.
Everything should go into that. They're all, in a sense, mysteries, but some are faster moving than others. So, you know, we talk a lot on these shows who I would suggest this for. And actually, Bridget Quinn's favorite novelist, I think, and maybe her hero, a favorite novelist is Lee Child, and her fictional hero is, of course, Reacher, Jack Reacher. And so for people who like that kind of very fast-moving, page-turning, is the heroine or hero going to get out of trouble? Is she going to come out of this alive? This is the book for you.
I love how you talk about Bridget Quinn as if she was a real person.
I know. Well, that's, you know, that's how I felt. She's a little bit snarky about herself and everybody. This is her first marriage at age, you know, 59 or 60. She's still trying to work out, after all these years of being undercover, work out how to be honest with people that she cares about. And it's nice to see a main character in a mystery or a main character in a thriller who is flawed.
You've sold me. The author is Becky Masterman, just like it sounds. And the first in a trilogy so far, maybe it's going to be more books, is called Rage Against the Dying. New author, new thriller series, at least new to you, Nancy Pearl.
Yes, I assume many other people have read it, but I was very excited to find it.
The excited Nancy Pearl there with KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman. And you will find all of Nancy's book picks at our website, KUOW.org. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW today. Are you sipping from a green cup right now? You are if you went to Starbucks today. The company just rolled out its latest cup, this one a mosaic of more than 100 people from many walks of life. Starbucks says the mosaic was drawn in one continuous stroke by the designer named Shogo Ota, who owns Tireman Studio in Seattle. I see his LinkedIn profile says he's also been teaching at Seattle's School of Visual Concepts. Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz says the new cup is a symbol of unity, a reminder to be good to each other in this divisive time, a week before the election. This is KUOW Seattle. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Sexual assault has become an issue in the presidential campaign, with new allegations against Donald Trump, old allegations against Hillary Clinton's husband. I'm going to read you an excerpt from a personal essay from the Seattle Story Project. This is a project at KUOW.org where we publish first-person stories. I want to let you know ahead of time, some listeners may find this story disturbing. The writer's name is Tara Weaver, and she writes, "The first man who kissed me when I didn't want him to was the boyfriend of my babysitter. He lifted me up by my armpits, sat me on the kitchen counter, leaned over me, and slid his tongue into my mouth. I was 8 years old. I don't know why he thought he could do this. I wasn't acting sexy. I was reading Beverly Cleary books and wishing I could be a horse. Do you think he had been listening to locker room banter?" That is one of several attacks that Tara describes in her essay, which she wrote after the second presidential debate when Donald Trump said his talk of sexual assault was just locker room banter. Tara goes on to write, "I have a better answer for the question I once asked my therapist. Why is it that I have experienced so much abuse, so much violence in my life? It's because I am a woman, because there is simply that much violence against women in this world." You can read the entire essay at the front page of our website. It's part of our Seattle Story Project, First Person Reflections, published at KUOW.org. At the bottom of Tara's essay, you'll see how you can submit your story. Thanks for joining us at KUOW.org. Thanks for joining us here, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, news and information. I'm sure you've seen that shaky video, the blurry video of Bigfoot, or Sasquatch as we call him here. You've seen the big hairy creature walking upright to the trees and glancing back at the camera for a split second. Well, now you're about to hear the story of the man who helped capture that famous film clip. Bob Gimlin is a rancher from Central Washington. Outside Magazine writer Leah Satilli tells us how, in 1967, Gimlin joined the man with the camera, Roger Patterson.
They were rodeo buddies. And Patterson, who was the Bigfoot aficionado, said, "I got to tell you about all this Bigfoot stuff I've been seeing and getting into." And over time, Gimlin, the non-believer, was kind of wooed into, yeah, maybe there is something out there. And so when Patterson heard about tracks in the redwoods in Northern California, he asked Gimlin to drive him down because he had a horse trailer and that sort of thing. So they went looking for Bigfoot and saw Bigfoot. So they were in the woods for a number of weeks. I believe they were there for over 30 days. And they were kind of getting ready to pack it up and take it back home again because they'd been gone for so long. When they kind of rounded this bend one day and they smelled, then saw this big hairy beast walking through the woods and were caught it on film.
For those who haven't seen that film, I certainly have.
Yeah.
Many, many times. It was a great obsession of mine as a child. Will you relate the story of what supposedly happened at that moment?
On the film?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what they saw was supposedly, I think the creature was crouching or something near a riverbed. But what they captured on film was this female Bigfoot or Sasquatch.
How do we know it's a female?
She had large breasts.
Oh,
and so,
I didn't notice that as a child.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of, I mean, now the film has really been kind of like worked over and remastered and that kinds of things. So you can see it a lot clearer, but probably when you saw it as a kid, you were seeing that rough, really shaky cut of it.
Yep.
So they see this female Bigfoot walking at a pretty brisk pace away from them and does the signature look over the shoulder at them and before it disappears into the woods.
Right.
So that look over the shoulder, I think, is the thing that everybody knows.
Oh, yes.
As Bigfoot.
Yes. The subject of many a meme.
Yes.
And again, if that was somebody in a gorilla suit, they played it cool. I mean, the Bigfoot is not hamming it up, right?
It's just
that one brief look over, like a quizzical look over the shoulder, and then it's got
like,
she's got someplace to go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that is the question, is that over the years, people have come out and said, "I was the guy in the costume. I sold them the costume," this, that, and the next thing, but no one has been able to definitively prove that. There are no receipts. There's no proof of this legend or this prank in the making. You know, there really is a lot of question into whether it's real or not.
I hear some credulousness there.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting because I think that everybody enters this idea as a complete skeptic, right? I mean, Bigfoot, how do we believe in that? When I started to try and find, okay, then what is the evidence disproving it? I was not able to find that.
And the story is that Bob Gimlin was one of those skeptics before he wasn't. You profiled Bob Gimlin. Tell us more about him.
Sure. Yeah. So actually, my stumbling into the story was, I mean, as a kid, I loved watching this footage. It was so mysterious. And I live in the Portland area and heard about this group called the Bigfoot Lunch Club, and they were hosting an event with Bob Gimlin. And I couldn't believe, I didn't think he was still alive. So I went to the event, heard him speak, saw that he was this kind of cartoonish cowboy figure in which this entire room was, ready to just like get on their knees for him. They just treated him like he was the Pope.
What do you mean he was cartoonish?
He's just very, he looks like a character. He wears a big, huge hat and a big, huge belt buckle and Wranglers, and he talks like this.
Okay.
And it's real slow. So I was immediately drawn to him, and when I started just kind of looking into the Patterson-Gimlin film, realized every single book that I was reading or every article was giving Patterson's side and saying, Gimlin has never spoke about this film. So when I saw him that night, I just said, would you be willing to talk about it? And he said, sure. So I wondered how much of it was that no one had ever asked. And so over a series of phone calls and meetings in person, I was able to get Bob's side of the story.
How did Bob Gimlin's life change when that video came out in 1960?
In 67. Yeah. So when they got back home, Roger immediately, thought he struck gold and wanted to take the film on tour, and he did. Bob was a lot more skeptical of what they even saw, said that he thought it looked way more impressive in person than what he saw on film, and he really wasn't all that excited about the idea of taking it on tour because he didn't feel this great need to see it again. He knew what he saw, whereas Roger wanted to raise the money to be able to go back to Northern California to go on another expedition to find this Bigfoot.
Wait a minute. How can Gimlin not have been excited by having seen Bigfoot with his naked eyes and they had video
of it? I think he was excited. I think he was just like, I have no idea what I saw. I just know that I have to get back to work and I have a family to take care of and that kind of thing.
Wait a minute.
I mean, he
doesn't think it's a someone in a suit. I mean, he saw Bigfoot. He doesn't want the world to know.
I think that's a great question. And I think that actually speaks to central traits of Bob's character, which is, let me put it this way. When I wrote this story, his response was, gosh, that sure is a big fuss that we made. And I think he felt very much like telling his story was just making too big of a fuss, which I think is somewhat characteristic of someone who lives in a very rural area and works a very humble lifestyle. Whereas Roger wanted to get famous.
Okay.
Roger wanted to be the guy that saw Bigfoot.
That wasn't
did.
His style. So Roger,
yeah.
You go and take this
do
all
thing.
Over. You do go. You be P.T. Barnum or whatever.
Exactly.
Around the world.
And Gimlin sold his rights off to the film for less than $10 because he was just like, I don't want anything to do with it anymore. So that was not the end of it, though, for Gimlin. Him just saying to people, I saw Bigfoot, made him seem crazy in this very small town where he always knew everyone. And all of a sudden, his word was kind of questioned, I think. And your word in that kind of an area where things are done with handshakes and a good word was thrown into question.
Oh.
And it made him seem crazy, I think, to be out about the fact that he saw or believed in Bigfoot when people were like, that's crazy.
So maybe that's why he wanted to back away from
it. Yeah,
so
he definitely backed away. Him and his wife, they both backed away. Bob didn't want to talk about it anymore because they didn't want to be the crazy people that believed in Bigfoot.
Patterson died almost 45 years ago.
Yeah, he died in his late 30s.
Yeah, 5 years after this video mm-hmm. came out. Gimlin had been silent, but as you say, but now he's meeting with fans, right?
Absolutely,
he's going
yeah.
to going to Bigfoot conventions, Sasquatch conventions.
Yep.
Why?
Well, I think that it has to do a lot with the community that the internet built around Bigfoot. So whereas in the 60s and 70s saying, I saw Bigfoot, you're probably going to be the only person in a small town that's going to admit to that. But as time went on and the internet created these forums of people, ways for people who believe in Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster or whatever to get together and form a community, when Bob was sort of convinced by other people to emerge from his silence about Bigfoot, he saw that this huge community had formed in a way based on what he had seen.
You have a quote in your story, somebody saying, meeting Bob Gimlin is like meeting the president or the pope.
Mm-hmm.
Why do people, you know, Sasquatch believers, Bigfoot believers, hold him in such high esteem?
Yeah, I think that that was my central interest in the story, was finding that out. And I think that these folks see him as something of a seer, as a prophet in a way, that he's the guy that saw the thing that they all believe in and live to tell the tale. And the fact that he has never backed down from the fact that he saw Bigfoot and that the film has never been disproven, it really is the Holy Grail. If, I mean, obviously, if they were able to find a receipt for the costume, that's out the window. But because it's held up over all of these years, I mean, we're rounding near the 50th year and hasn't been disproven. And look at all the ways that we have to do that. I think that that's what makes him so precious to this community.
Leah, we haven't really touched on the possibility that Bob Gimlin is just a big liar.
Yeah, yeah. And that was, you know, I felt like that was my job, is to really weigh in on what the skeptics think. There is a very prominent skeptic named Greg Long who wrote a book called The Making of Bigfoot. And it's really examining everyone that has said, I was the guy that sold the suit. I was the guy in the suit. And he brought up some really good points that I thought were interesting, not so much about whether the Patterson-Gimlin film is real, but whether or not the Bigfoot community can ever admit that maybe it was fake, that now there's an entire industry around Bigfoot. You know, you see him everywhere. On my way here today, I saw a Bigfoot sticker on the back of a car and in the shape of the Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot. So it's an industry. There are museums. People charge hundreds of dollars to take people on expeditions, you know, in the Dark Divide near Mount Adams. They need it to be real because it's a livelihood for them at this point. And I thought that was a really interesting take on it.
What do you think, Leah? I want to know.
Well,
Sasquatch.
You know, it's I think the little kid in me wants to believe that there is a world that we live in where we don't know everything. And I think that that's exciting. Do I think that there are, you know, Sasquatch and big feet or whatever all around us? No, I don't. Do I think that they saw something that day in the woods? That, yeah, I do. I do think that there's a lot of evidence that said that they did. That may have been a man in a suit. So it's hard for me. It's really hard for me to say. I'm just not willing to say that I'm a complete Bigfoot believer, but I'm open to the idea of it.
Leah, you have said that it's nice to have mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
I like the idea that we don't have everything figured out.
You're a journalist. Why would you want us to not have things figured out?
I recently did another story where I spoke to people who were a part of the Explorers Club. So people who have, the first people who landed on the moon, the first people to get to the bottom of the ocean, they're all members. And I was speaking with the president about these sorts of things, mystery in the world. And he said, our members discovered a new species in Central Park. And I believe it was some kind of like bug or worm or something like that. And I love that idea that there are mysteries hidden in plain sight. So I think that that was a big part of what fueled me to continue reporting this, was that idea of, is there a mystery behind this story? Is there a possibility that there's something out there? And maybe has no one been willing to say that they're going to entertain that idea? You know, that they're too much of an adult to say that maybe there's a Bigfoot out there. I'm not too much of an adult to try and play with that idea, I guess.
Leah Sottile is a Portland-based writer, and we're tweeting out a link to her profile of Bob Gimlin and the history of that famous Bigfoot film footage. So join us at KUOW. Well, Bigfoot may or may not have lived, Phil Collins is not dead. That's the title of Collins' new memoir, Not Dead Yet, which I bring up because we're talking to Phil Collins today. In case you don't know, he was huge in the 80s with Genesis and as a solo act. When I was in college, the song Against All Odds played on the radio every 90 seconds. Remarkable for a 3-minute song. I don't know how they did that. Anyway, Phil Collins has been through a lot, including partial deafness and 3 divorces. He'll tell you his story this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. There's so much we need to say to you. on KOW's The Record. Remember, anything you missed is waiting for you as a podcast, so subscribe to any and all of KOW's podcasts at iTunes or KOW.org, or take a look at us now any place you get your podcasts.